Maura Murray was born on May 4th, 1982, in Hanson, Massachusetts. By the age of 21, she was 5'7 and 120 pounds. On February 9th, 2004, in Haverhill, New Hampshire, Maura Murray crashed her car on Route 112. There has never been a confirmed sighting of Maura since that night. If you have any information on the whereabouts of Maura Murray, please contact the New Hampshire State Police. This is the Missing Maura Murray Podcast. Welcome to the Missing Maura Murray Podcast. For this episode, we have an interview with investigative journalist Clint Harding. I hope you enjoy it, and Lance and I will be there to bookend the episode. Thank you very much for listening, and please follow us on Twitter at Maura Murray Doc, D-O-C. Welcome to the show, investigator Clint Harding.
Thank you, and thanks for having me, guys. I appreciate it. And like others have said, you know, you guys do a really good job. And I look forward to this documentary coming out. I like the fact that you're kind of taking the time to try to kind of separate facts from maybe just pure speculation. And I think that's what this case needs, is that we need the factual information, and we can come up with all kinds of theories off that factual information. But as long as we're working with real information, you know, that's what really this is about. And that's honestly how I think this case is ever going to get solved.
Well, that's great. Thank you very much. Yeah, if you were to read a certain Reddit page, you would believe that this podcast was all speculation. But we are doing our best to weed through the...
Oh, and it takes time. Oh, I know that. It takes time with this case in particular. You can never know this case enough, you know. You never know enough about this case to really... to come up with that great conclusion. There's always something out there.
Yeah. So what's your background?
My background? Well, yeah, I don't know how far you want to go back there, but I live in Centralia, Illinois. I'm from Southern Illinois. After high school, I joined the Air Force, served for 4 years. I did two different tours in Kuwait, and I also went to a little island in the Caribbean Sea with 19 other Americans, and we spent 4.5 months out there. That's probably where I grew up, is, you know, getting that experience at that young of an age. So after my Air Force career, I went to Southern Illinois University in Carbondale, and I ended up joining the journalism program my senior year. I worked for the college newspaper as a sports reporter. And from there, just kind of went into journalism full time. Worked for 14 years as a sports reporter. Then I became a sports editor of a newspaper, and that's went till 2014. And then I decided to do a complete career change and go back into Department of Defense work, and that's what I'm doing right now.
Excellent, excellent. So, just want to first thank you for the service that you've done.
No problem.
Your tours in Kuwait and everything, and that's really honorable. So, just want to put that out there. Yeah. And when did you discover the Maura Murray case?
Well, technically, I think I saw like a 2020 episode. I think that was what came first as far as television coverage of the case. At least, you know, unless you were local, I think they had a more local show that came out earlier. But that was the first show. Really didn't do much for me then. It was the show on the ID channel, the disappeared episode of Maura Murray. So whenever that debuted, that was the first time I really got interested in this case. And, you know, I saw Fred Murray on the TV screen, and I just wanted to reach out and give him a hug, to be honest with you, because I truly believe that he has complete real grief. It shows in that video. You know, that was several years after his daughter went missing, but the grief is really still alive right there. And I just felt really bad for him. I really wanted to do something. You know, I didn't know what I could do. But I really wanted to learn about this case, and you know, I think that's what really hooked me, is I spent a long time researching this case. I didn't go on message boards. I didn't do any kind of public speaking about this. I just researched, and And, you know, and it is that frustration of thinking that you're onto something and then maybe it leads down a rabbit hole. I think that's what kind of just kept you going. It got you, it was like a challenge, you know, you just felt like something was taunting at you and saying you can't do anything. And by golly, I like a challenge. So I wanted to keep at it and try to do my part to try to get some real information out there. And that's how I felt like I could help. I felt like, you know, I could get real information by researching and doing what I normally do anyway. And after that, you know, maybe I can help in some way.
Right. Now, you were just talking about Fred Murray, and the first thing that occurred to you when you saw him on the Disappeared episode was just his real grief, and you just, you know, you said you wanted to reach out and give him a hug, but there's a fairly large amount of people that have lost a lot of trust in him, and right. I was just wondering what you thought about that.
Oh, yeah. I think it's very legit as far as that goes. There's a lot of spin that's going on in this case, and it's not just family members. It's not just police. The police are going to be the police. They're going to say what they're going to say because, you know, they're just so limited in what they can tell the public anyway. There's just a lot of spin, and so it comes down to the research. You just really have to research and understand not just what people say, but what is the context and why are they saying this and that kind of thing. And when it comes to some of the things Fred has said, there's definitely room for questioning out there. You know, so I won't go as far as to say that, you know, I think he's in on something. I don't believe that. I think he really legitimately did not know what happened tomorrow that night. You know, but I, you know, my theory does go away from some of the more popular theories that you probably hear.
Yeah, I do agree about the Disappeared episode, and I believe that was when I started really focusing on this case too, but I did leave feeling almost heartbroken for Fred Murray.
Right.
Yeah, and you know, it depends on what you think of him, but you can watch that same episode and feel that this guy is lying or this guy is trying to make people feel bad for him, I feel like.
Well, and or anybody that's associated with this case, you kind of have to second guess what they're really saying. Are they really mean? Is this really what they believe? I mean, so it's a lot of characters in this case.
There
it
are.
Takes a long time to go over them all. But, you know, what I kind of wanted to do is just, I don't know what you guys wanted out of me, but I wanted to kind of just talk about some different aspects of this case, and we can kind of look over the information, and then I'll leave it up to the listeners to decide. I'll leave it up to you guys to decide, you know, what you think.
Yeah.
Yeah, I love it.
You can start at a number of different places with this case, but I think the place I would start if I was truly investigating this case would be October of 2003. That would be my starting date to look at this case, and that was a weekend. It was Columbus Day weekend. Mara and Fred went hiking, and if my information is correct, I truly believe they actually drove by the very same spot that Mara went missing in during that weekend hiking trip.
Where did they go hiking? Do you happen to know the trail?
Oh yeah, I know. They went all over the place. Actually, they started out in Stowe, Vermont. They headed towards Burlington, Vermont, and then they made their way over to the White Mountains, where they went to Owl's Head Mountain, which is off the 112, Route 112, and they also went to West Bond. And that is where Fred, I think he completed his 48th mountain that was 4,000 feet or higher. It's called the New Hampshire 48, or I don't know what the official name of it is, but there's 48 mountains in New Hampshire that reach over 4,000 feet, and he was completing his final one that weekend. And at the top of the, I guess, the summit, Mara reached in her knapsack and pulled out a ginger ale to give to him, I guess, to signify the completion of his 48th mountain that weekend. So that's where I would start. Not just the fact that they may have driven by that spot that weekend, but the other fact is that when Mara went missing, they found on her computer directions let's see, driving directions to the Burlington area, which is where they were in October. So we're talking, 4 months prior?
Right.
So, she's got driving directions to Burlington on her computer, and in her car there was a note card with directions to Burlington. She also called the Stowe, Vermont hotline, which maybe she didn't get a hold of anybody because I think that line wasn't working that weekend or that day that she called. And then on top of that, where'd she end up? She ends up in the White Mountains on Route 112. At the night that she went missing. So I think the directions, you know, I think there's a common ground there with the directions. She's searching for a mountain area to go to. I think that proves that she didn't have a definite plan. I mean, if she had a definite plan, I think she would have known, you know, hours before she went where she was going. Burlington and the White Mountains are in two different locations, even though they're, you know, you can travel the same road to get between both of them. So, you know, you look at something like that, and I think that says a lot, personally. So,
yeah, that's interesting stuff. You said that she had a note card in her car?
Note card in her car that her dad described, and her dad described it as referring to Burlington, the Burlington area. So,
where did you find that information?
Those were in news articles that were done in the earlier days that Mara went missing. I may have one of those on hand. I'd have to try to dig that up there. But
see, that's good though, because what we're looking for as, like, you know, information that is as close to the time of the disappearance as possible.
Exactly, and that was found inside her car after she went missing. That note card. It was returned to the family, all her stuff in the car, and that was one of the items that was recovered.
Oh.
So that's where it would start with me, is in October, just because, you know, you find those driving, you find the directions on her computer, the directions in her car, and the fact where she ended up, and they all kind of tie in together. So, you know, it doesn't mean anything in particular, but that would be a starting point for me if I was investigating this case.
Well, absolutely, and it doesn't mean anything if the person doesn't go missing.
Exactly.
You know what I mean? It means something now, because you got to look at all the events leading up to the disappearance to try to solve it.
I do think she was an avid hiker. I think it went beyond, you know, her family. They talk about going annually to make trips, maybe to the White Mountains or wherever. But I think it was a way bigger. I don't know if they're just kind of downplaying her love of hiking or not, but I think her hiking, I won't say the word obsession, but I think she really enjoyed hiking a lot, and it's something that she could, I think she would spend her last moments in the White Mountains if she could.
So you've been to the scene of the accident, correct?
Correct. I think it was the summer of 2011. I happened to go on a last minute little vacation with my sister and her husband. They were going to the Foxwoods Casino, and I just decided I didn't want to tag along with them all weekend. So, and I knew about this case, and I realized I was going to be pretty close to everything. So I spent my whole weekend just going through everything that I could find that had to do with this case. I spent the night at the same hotel Fred and Mara, or Fred actually stayed in Hadley, Massachusetts. I can't even say that right. But after that night, I spent the next day at UMass. I went to the dorm that Mara lived in. I went to the nearby dorm that she worked in. I ate at the same brew pub that they ate at. I just really wanted to try to get a feel of the area and that kind of thing. And then the following day, I went up to New Hampshire. I took the route that I believe that she took, just also to see how long it would take me and just kind of get a feel for things. And I ended up spending the night in Littleton, which at the time had something to do with this case. So they found some human remains in a horse cemetery near Littleton. And
right.
Some people were saying, hey, this could be Mara Murray. So I wanted to get up there, and they were, I mean, it was ongoing at the time that I was there, but it ended up being obviously not her. So that's where I stayed. But when I stayed there, I drove to the accident location and spent some time there.
So just for the listeners who are not familiar with the New England area, Foxwoods is
in Connecticut.
Not close to the crash site.
No, we flew into Bridgeport, Connecticut, and I drove from Bridgeport to Hadley and UMass area, which really isn't that far. But then from UMass to New Hampshire, it's a couple hours. It's a nice little hike.
Right, which shows your dedication to this. I just wanted to point that out.
Yeah.
Well, thank you.
So what did you learn from taking this trip?
Oh, I learned a ton of things. The first thing I learned about was something I wasn't even planning on looking at all, and that was the, I'm sure you guys have probably even talked about the Patrick Vasi possible connection to Mara Murray.
Definitely.
Well, I stumbled on the exact location that Patrick Vasi was found laying in the road, and I wasn't planning on that at all. And it was right after I left the dorms, right after I left where Mara was working. I was hungry. I didn't know my way around yet the campus, but I knew the general location of the restaurant. So I got in my rental car and I made my first right. And it was like a minute later, there I am, right at the location. I recognized it right away, the triangle in Mattoon, the intersection. And it was like, it just made me think a little bit. It's like, God, I was always led to believe this happened way away from campus, way away from where Mara was working. So I never put any credit into the possibility that maybe she was involved in the hit and run. But that really kind of changed my, it made me look into it. Let's put it that way.
So the accident site where Patrick Vasi was struck was really close to where Mara was working at the time.
It was less than a mile. It was 0.9 miles. I just did a Google search of that because, it was 0.9 miles away. It was one turn, basically. You turn off of Massachusetts Avenue onto Pleasant, and Pleasant becomes Triangle, and then Triangle intersects into Mattoon all very quickly. And so, yeah.
Did that area of road strike you as an easy area for a pedestrian to get hit, or just?
It really did. It really did. And you know, again, and this is—it's not a good comparison because I was there in the summertime, mm-hmm. so you don't have active students there. But that spot was pretty active that night. It was around 5-6 o'clock at night. A lot of people out walking, and it was pretty busy in that specific area. So yes, it definitely seems like a pretty good spot for me for somebody to get hit. Of course, I'm some idiot from Southern Illinois just driving around, so I'm probably a danger to everybody at that time, no matter where I was. So, but on the Vasi hit and run angle, I don't personally subscribe to it fully yet, but I will say that I've never been personally able to discount it, and it kind of bothers me at times because the stuff kind of fits nicely if she was involved in that hit and run. It explains things, and you know, that kind of bothers me.
Yeah, it would seem to give a solid motive for her to want to disappear.
Well, you know that, but it explains why the father swoops into town a day later with a bunch of money. It's almost like, I don't know, it explains it pretty well. The father showed that the Friday after her breakdown at work, which was the same night that the hit and run occurred and same time frame, they had a real bad storm, and Friday everything was canceled. School was canceled, all their sporting events were canceled, and yet the next morning, Saturday morning, Fred's coming to town, and he's coming from at least two plus hours away. And I just always found that a little odd. And so he comes into town, and I don't know if they're trying to dump her car or not. The fact that they're going around telling everybody that the car's in super bad shape, you know, that could just be a story. They could have hid the car for the weekend, and might also explain why she didn't have her car that night. They went back to the dorms.
You just said that they were going around telling people that the car was in super bad shape. We've had other accounts of no one ever mentioning how bad of shape the car was in. Are you saying that they were after the fact, after the disappearance, how bad the car was?
Let me be clear. We are totally in speculation mode right now, so let's be clear about that. And I don't know the full story on that. I know in the media, it's made out that her car was in bad running shape. And, you know, this, my speculation on that is maybe it wasn't in such bad shape and maybe it was drivable, but maybe they didn't want it to be seen that weekend and they're trying to come up with some kind of cover story for why her car couldn't be available that weekend.
Sure, sure.
But that's just one little speculative piece of information there.
Which is all we're really left with.
On that, yes. So just to get back to the hit and run, the hit and run occurs. He's found at 12:20 exactly on that intersection, or he's actually laying out. I think he's by the curb, laying flat out. Mara Murray was on her shift at the time, but she did make a phone call from 12:07 a.m. to 12:14 a.m. That phone call, you will never find that phone call talked about anywhere. That's, you know, right there, that's a red flag to me. I don't know, and it doesn't necessarily have to do with Patrite Vossi hit and run. It's just a red flag that nobody ever has ever talked about the phone call that she made from 12:07 a.m. to 12:14 a.m. when and Patrite Vossi's hit at 12:20. So you got a time frame there that kind of matches up, and, you know, you think somebody, maybe they're on a break or something, they might run right to their cell phone. So
this is her cell phone record.
Her cell phone record. I'm looking at it right now. And it was it was a phone call between her and her boyfriend from 12:07 a.m. to 12:14 a.m. Now, we hear about the phone call that Mara and her sister had between 10:10 and 10:38 p.m., but we know for a fact that Mara didn't break down at work until around 1. So, obviously, a 10:10 to 10:38 phone call to try to link that to a 1 a.m., 12:45 a.m. breakdown is a big stretch for anybody.
So let me just clarify a little bit here. So Mara, that night of the accident, of the Patrite Vossi accident, she spoke with her sister for about a half an hour.
10:10 to 10:38.
Okay. And then she went on break. And during
I do not know that she went. I'm speculating that she went on break. Part I'm speculating.
Oh, okay. But because she had made a different phone call to her boyfriend.
At 12:07 to 12:14.
And Patrite Vossi was found in the road at 12:20?
Exactly 0.9 miles away, yes.
And what time was he hit?
Well, they speculate. I mean, we just have to guess, yeah, because he was found at 12:20, but who knows how long it took for that to be reported and for people to respond. The police were on scene and saw him at 12:20 a.m.
Okay, so it is reasonable, though, to assume that if she was on her break when she made the call to Billy, that it could have come after she hit Patrite.
Exactly. Yeah.
Okay. Just
or during the phone call.
Right. Exactly. Okay. I just wanted to clarify. That's really interesting.
And I want to touch on one more point on the Vossi angle.
Sure.
Okay. Because a lot of people have brought this up. The fact that, you know, what about the investigation into that? Bottom line is there was never an investigation done on that. It was never determined if he was hit by a car, or if he maybe had been playing around and he was car surfing and he fell. It was 2 months after his accident. He was in a coma for 2 months. He finally came to, and then the police were trying to get some information out of him. So we're talking 2 months after the fact. So with no information, no real investigation going on, There's nothing, you know, Mara Murray, if she was involved, she wouldn't know that, though.
She wouldn't know that there was any investigation, right?
Right. And the day that she went missing was the day that the school newspaper ran with the story of the hit and run. But that doesn't tie her to it or anything.
Right.
But the day that she went missing, the story came out about the hit and run in the school newspaper. And in fairness, I think the town newspaper put out a story about the hit and run like the morning after. So I don't want to make it sound like that she bolted the minute the story hit or anything like that. Well, I had something I wanted to read to you guys, and I can't find it. It was a quote from Vossi's mom that she had made to a newspaper talking about how Patrite Vossi, the investigation was never happened, basically. Here it is right here. Her direct quote is, "He doesn't know what happened and nobody investigated for him." And that's from Mrs. Vossi, and her actual name is Aphrodite Vossi.
But we do know which way Petrit would have been walking, right?
He was coming from a friend's house. That is known. And they've talked to the friend. I know they have talked to the friend. This is all like months later. Mm-hmm. So I'm sure they have a good idea of where he was when he was struck.
Okay. So I'm just trying to think. I wonder if Maura had made that turn from her work onto the street where Vassie was hit, if he would have been on the left side of the road walking back towards school, or if he would have been on the right side of the road.
I think he would have been on her passenger side, walking towards her driver's side.
Okay.
All his injuries were to one side of his body, and that's something, if you're car surfing and you, I guess if you were to make a nice little tumble, I don't think your injuries would be that consistent. So that's another reason why the car surfing angle doesn't really make a whole lot of sense. But it was something they didn't know what happened to him. And really, to this day, they don't know what happened to him. He does not want to know if Maura Murray was involved. He doesn't want to know who hit him.
Really?
Yes, and he's said that he's talked a few times on message boards, not a lot, but when he has, he's made it very clear he does not want to know what happened. He wants to put that part of his life completely behind him.
That's really interesting. I can see where he would be coming from with that. Yeah. What nationality is Vassie?
That's a good question. I do not know. I do not know. I have not looked that deep into this, really.
Yeah, I'm just thinking about the time frame of where the country was at in 2004, and no investigation on this guy. You know, I'm wondering if it was someone named, like Bob Smith, like from Middle America. Like, would they have actually put forth a better investigation into
that's
this
been said a lot on message boards and the like. So yeah, I mean, that thought is definitely something that people have brought up, but in fairness, the guy's in a coma for 2 months, so really you can't get to the bottom of anything until he can probably speak for himself. And maybe they thought when he came out he'd be able to tell them exactly what happened, but wasn't the case. So yeah, I don't want to spend all time on that, because that's just, she could very well have not had anything to do with what happened to Mr. Vassie. It's just a very odd coincidence, like a lot of things in this case.
Yeah. Right, and like a lot of things, once you start talking about one fact that happened that could have been connected to this, you start rolling with everything,
Yeah, there's definitely a lot of speculation and a lot of things are coincidence, but at some point one of these coincidences must not be a coincidence, right?
You'd think. And boy, and you know what, that I think that has kind of driven me. You hear stuff and it sounds great and it sounds like you're gonna really uncover something, and then the next thing you know, you're back to square one. So what are you gonna do?
What was the strangest thing that you uncovered during your trip?
During my trip?
Or the most interesting thing?
Well, just interesting for me was just to be able to see everything. You hear about it, you read about it, and just to be able to see things for yourself. I'm in my mind, the picture that I had made about the case from reading about it all these years was a lot different when you're actually there. Seeing it, mm-hmm. Seeing things like the dorm locations, Melville and Kennedy. I mean, you walk out of the Melville front door and you're literally steps away from Kennedy. And all along I envisioned the supervisor kind of carrying Maura halfway across campus and this big dramatic scene. And really it's just, you walk out one door and you're right at the next door, things of that nature.
Well, let's talk about Maura's old supervisor.
Okay.
So you interviewed her, and we read your email on the air. I believe it was episode 3, our questions and comments episode. What feeling did you get from her?
I felt that there's a lot of built-up guilt in her. I think she just really haunts her. This case really haunts her. And, they were friends. I wouldn't call them great friends. But I think it was beyond a little work. I think they were, friends. But I think it just haunts her because she saw somebody that kind of even reminded her of herself in a little ways with some of the issues that Maura was facing, maybe, or And I just kind of felt like she always felt like maybe she should have done a little bit more that night, that same night there, because she saw somebody in crisis mode, and she really tried to get Mara to go see a counselor that night. She didn't want to wait. She wanted to send Mara right to a crisis counselor right from her shift. And you know, she ended up taking Mara back to her dorm, and she wanted to go and spend some time with Mara. Didn't want to leave her alone, but Mara kind of told a little fib, said that she had a roommate and that she'd be okay. So that was really the last that the supervisor ever heard from Mara, and really didn't hear much else until everybody else heard about her going missing. So
take us back to when you were talking to the supervisor. It's Karen Mayotte, right?
Yes, correct.
Yeah, take us back to when you talked to Karen through when she first discovers that Mara was under some sort of distress.
Correct. You know, it's just the whole thing's just bizarre. She comes in, she gets notified that Mara's upset. So she goes to respond. She walks into the front desk area. Mara's sitting at the desk. She walks right up to Mara. I mean, like face to face, like just a one little desk separating the two. And she starts to talk to Mara, but Mara's looking straight past her, not responding to her, not saying a word. She's not crying at this point. She's just staring ahead. And so the supervisor kind of keeps prodding and trying to find out what's wrong, and Mara just not saying nothing. Finally, at some point, Mara breaks down and starts crying just uncontrollably, and the supervisor, you know, is obviously trying to console her. And at the same time, you have students that are coming in. They're wanting to get into the dorm, and Mara's just not, she's just not there. And, you know, it's just the supervisor really doesn't know what to do, but she realizes that Mara's just not in a place to be working, that's for sure. So she actually, you know, relieves Mara, tells Mara, you know, you're done. You can pack your stuff and go home. And Mara's not getting up. Mara's just sitting there, and she's back to staring again. And the supervisor, I think the supervisor finally just kind of took the bull by the horns and went up and started packing Mara's stuff for her, and then had to actually kind of walk towards the door with Mara's stuff to kind of alert to her that, hey, it's time to go. And so that's when Mara got up, and the supervisor helped her out of the dorm, and they walked over to Kennedy, walked inside, and the supervisor tried to get Mara to let her come up to her room with her, and Mara said that she'd be okay, and that's where they parted.
Based on the feeling you get from Karen, does it feel like she believed Mara was in real distress, or that she was putting on an act to get out of work?
Absolutely not an act. Absolutely not an act, and yeah, real distress. And like I said, I think Karen, you know, really wishes that she would have just kind of forced herself to take more action than what actually happened. But, you know, you can't blame the supervisor in that situation at all. I mean, but the story, you know, is that maybe Mara was just trying to get out of work or maybe something like that. And I that's one hell of an acting job, you know, not just to do it when the supervisor arrives, but then to keep on going with the act, even after you've already been released.
Right.
It's just a little much for me to believe.
Yeah. I've faked my way out of school before for being sick, and I kept it up all day and night.
Did you?
Let's be clear that you went to school for acting.
That is true as well.
Well, and again, she's released. There's really no, at that point, I mean, I don't mean she just has to put a smile on her face and pack up her stuff and run out of the building, but, you know, she's released and she's just stuck there. And I understand that college kids, I was one of them at one time in my life, you know, everything is a little more dramatic. Everything seems a little more tragic to a college kid, but this doesn't sound like a typical boyfriend-girlfriend spat or something like that. This sounds like something really traumatic happened, whether it was by a phone call, whether it was, you know, who knows.
Right.
And we don't know. We don't know the answer to what caused her to be upset like that.
Exactly. All we know is that, you know, like you said, Tim, we've all done things like that where we faked being sick and, you know, we've gotten out of situations. But I feel like I've said this numerous times during our podcasts. We don't go missing after. So it's not a big deal. So it's a big deal because these are the things that, that happened to her. This is the way she reacted to whatever situation comes her way, and then she goes missing. So that's why we're looking into all these things. What did Karen say about the phone call?
She did not say anything directly about a phone call. She did do a police statement after Mara had gone missing. And in that statement, she had referred to the fact that Mara had pointed down to her cell phone and blurted out the words, "my sister," when supervisor kept prodding her, and I guess Mara was given an answer. So that's what she wrote in the police statement, that Mara said, "my sister." And after that, I know the police were highly interested in trying to track down whoever called Mara that night. And they ended up coming out saying in the press that basically they found the phone call that upset Mara that night. She had talked to her sister. Well, that phone call was at 10 o'clock at night, and her being upset was closer to 1 in the morning. So that's they're taking a nice leap of faith there, going with that phone call as being the source of Mara becoming upset, just based off of her words, "my sister," which really could mean anything. But like I said, we get into the spin portion of this, is the fact that the family, they'll go on in the newspapers back then, they'll go all on about how the police keep referring to this phone call that upset Mara by Mara's sister. But nobody talks about the 12 o'clock phone call that was much closer in line to the time that Mara became upset. And it's kind of odd that you would keep mentioning this 10 o'clock phone call when you as a family person know for a fact that that's not the phone call that upset Mara. But yet the public doesn't know that. The public doesn't have access to her phone records, but yet you're going to keep on saying, bringing up that 10 o'clock phone call and keep bringing the fact that the police keep alerting on that. And the police maybe really do believe that that phone call had something to do with something, but the evidence is there. Her phone records are clear. Mm-hmm. She talked to at 10 o'clock and she talked again at 12 o'clock, and there was no phone calls in between those two.
Has her sister ever come out and given the details of the phone call that happened in that 10 o'clock hour?
Said that they regularly talk on the phone at night. This was not anything out of the ordinary at all, and they were just talking about normal relationship stuff and nothing out of the abnormal that she remembers would be anything that would trigger Mara to be in the kind of state that she was in.
And which sister was this, just so that we're clear?
Kathleen. This gotcha. Is the older sister.
So what do you know about the night of the accident?
I mean, we all kind of have heard the version of events, so I don't really want to just keep pouring over that. But Mara wrecked her car. It was sometime around 7:20 p.m. at night. It was right around a sharp curve on Route 112 there, right past a antique store that the neighbors that first called 911, they 911, they owned the antique store that Mara drove past right before she wrecked out. She hit us into a snowbank and got her car lodged in there, and her car was, I guess, damaged. At the accident site, what I wanted to really kind of talk on is something that doesn't get mentioned a whole lot, is that, you know, they found alcohol. They found a smash bottle or a smash box of Franzia wine in the back seat. They also found Tylenol PM in her car, and I don't know if many people have heard that.
No.
And I don't know. She could just take Tylenol PM with her everywhere she goes, and that's fine. And everybody, a lot of people take Tylenol. It's not doesn't mean anything.
Well, it does. It does mean a couple of different things. I think it means she had trouble sleeping, or she had pain and enjoyed the buzz of these during her sober and awake hours.
Okay, I do know for a fact that police did use this. They used a lot of things, but they used the Tylenol PM and the alcohol as a way to point towards the fact that she may have been there to harm herself.
Yeah.
So that's one angle, definitely.
Oh yeah, you pop two of those and have a glass of red wine and drive on a windy road. I dare you to come out without hitting a snowbank or a guardrail.
Yeah, that's interesting. Because when it's just, because what everybody has heard is that it's alcohol that was purchased at a liquor store, and it seems like alcohol that was purchased to be part of a gathering, a party or something. But when you add in those Tylenol PM in there, yeah, it does put another layer on this whole thing, which is, again, like speculating. It's you're gonna drink a bunch of alcohol. And you're gonna pop a bunch of Tylenol PMs and just let it go, you know?
Well, even if she wasn't taking the Tylenol PM then, say that she just took it to sleep, you know.
Yeah, we don't know if she took any, nothing like that. We just know that she did pack that with the stuff that she brought.
But I've taken Tylenol PM and I have some in my cabinet now, but I only use it when I'm having trouble sleeping. So but that also tells me something about the person who's taking it. If I have trouble sleeping, then that means I'm stressed out or something a little different is going on in my life. You know, I may have insomnia. Insomnia isn't a normal condition that people who are, you know, happy people, non-stressed people have. Very rarely, I'll say, would have that.
And she was a very good athlete. And at one time, I think she, I know family spokespeople have tried to definitely speak out about this. And they've said that she had a reoccurring knee injury and she was taking the Tylenol PM to kind of help that out, maybe to sleep, for instance, at nighttime. So, you know, but she hadn't run competitively in at least a year or more at the time of her accident. So, I don't know.
I could see it. No, it could be completely innocent. I just wanted to point
out. I want to make sure that's out there, though, because that's important, I think.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yep.
So, and then you have the bus driver who came across Mara. One of the first things that he did, as I understand, is he had to kind of get on her a little bit because she was sitting in the road with her car partially sticking in. She didn't have any lights on at all. Didn't have flashers on, nothing. And this is a dark car we're talking about. At nighttime, as anybody could have came around that corner and hit her again. And so she was sitting in her car. I have no idea what she was up to. But she didn't have any lights on. She doesn't sound like she was trying to bring attention to herself. And he just kind of stumbled upon her and confronted her.
So how far behind Mora do you think Butch was in his bus when she crashed? So she crashes and he shows up. Was he far enough, say, where he didn't see the taillights?
I can only guess. I'm going to say it's around 7:30, 7:35 in that range. Is when he arrived. We do know for a fact that he attempted to call 911 himself around 7:40. We know for a fact that the first 911 call came at 7:27. So between 7:27 and 7:40, he had his full interaction with her and made it to his house and called 911. So his first attempt to call 911 did not work. So he actually had to have the Hanover dispatch get in touch with the Grafton County dispatch to get his 911 call through the second time, and that came through at 7:43 p.m.
Was he calling from a cell phone or his home phone?
I think he yelled from his bus for his either wife or girlfriend. That's never been established to me if it was his wife or his girlfriend to call. So I think she called the first time, and then I think he kind of piggybacked, got on and helped his wife or girlfriend call and give the information out.
So what do you say to the people who believe that Butch may have been involved?
Timeline just doesn't add up for that. I mean, the guy, he's an older guy and just not enough time. I mean, my God, the only thing he could have done was to convince her to come with him to his house, hide her out until everybody left from that accident location that night, and then do something afterwards. And he lived in a house with his wife / girlfriend and his mother, and both of them, his mother worked for the police department at one time. I think she was a nurse at the time this happened. His wife was a bus driver, he was a bus driver. This is somebody, there's no possible way he was involved in anything sinister. But I wanted to really touch on this because this is not said a lot. The fact that that night there was kind of an investigation that took place, and it involved a lot of people. And I don't think that gets put out there a lot because of the way the news reports came out about that night. There was a volunteer fire monthly meeting going on around that the accident location. And so they all heard the call go out on the radio. And so we're talking, I think it was 12 people went just from that to the accident location. So you had this whole volunteer fireman force. You had emergency personnel respond. I think there was two guys from like EMS that responded. You had the lead investigator. He enlisted the help of the bus driver and the Westmans. I think they went to the antique store, the Weathered Barn, and I think they opened that up to see if maybe somehow she had gotten into there. And so you had a ton of people out looking that night for Mara. Just didn't find her.
Do you happen to know if the police searched the houses in the area?
The main guy, the first responder that showed up, he was on scene well past everybody else. He cleared the scene at 9:26 p.m. So that's, he was on scene after arriving at 7:29. So that's almost 2 full hours. So I would imagine that that included going house to house in that area and trying to talk to people. So he was on scene at least a half hour after the car was already towed. So I don't know what else he'd be doing during that time.
Yeah, talking to neighbors or possibly going to houses. That's very interesting.
And then we have the rag in the tailpipe, and it's been reported that the same officer that first responded is the guy that found the rag in the tailpipe. So then that gets into the whole, you know, situation. What Fred said, and does that add up, what Fred said about, you know, warning his daughter that if her car's smoking, to stick a rag in the tailpipe to kind of cover that up and all that stuff. And you know, I have never really been able to believe that account. I you know, just something about that just doesn't add up. And so when I try to put everything into context, and I'm going back to actual 911 logs the next day, when Fred is trying desperately to get a hold of this first responding officer because he has very important information he wants to tell him concerning his daughter, that information ends up being that he thinks his daughter went to the White Mountains to do personal harm to herself. And that's what the lead investigator of the case said was the first words out of Fred's mouth. So knowing that and knowing that the investigators are trying to put a picture of who Mara was, they think that she came to their area to do harm to herself. So when Fred actually gets to the area, they're going to start confronting him on this kind of stuff. And that's personally what I think happened, is I think they mentioned this rag in the tailpipe, and Fred had to come up with a quick answer for that, because it didn't take Fred long to realize that the suicide angle is bad, because police aren't going to pursue that like they would a missing an actual person of a crime that occurred that night. You know, if you have a person that walks away into the mountains and they're an adult and they did it on their own free will, you're not going to get the kind of investigation that you would get if it was somebody that met up with foul play.
So Fred tells the police that he thinks that Mara went into the woods to kill herself. How long between that and when he said she was probably abducted by some local dirtbag?
I don't personally have never talked to Fred, so I do not know. I can't go by his own word, which obviously would be very valuable to hear him talk about some of this stuff. But we can go by what he said in accounts and newspaper accounts. And in the days after Mara went missing, some of the things that he was directly quoted as saying is that, I don't know what the matter is or what trouble you think you might be in, but this isn't anything we can't solve. It's me. You can tell me. We'll work it out until we solve it. And that was a direct quote from him directly speaking to his daughter after she had gone missing. Okay, but 2 weeks later, he's completely changed his terms. And he said in one article, "We should think of this in terms of a criminal investigation. It sounds like it would be the key to expanding it. Let's grab the bull by the horns and call this foul play." And ever since then, he's pretty much stuck with a theory of a local dirtbag grabbing Mara.
So what happened in that time to change his point of view?
Yeah, and then we can only speculate.
Right.
But his statements are there. I mean, it's, you know, it's what he said. It's,
yeah,
his pleas early on were directly to Mara. They weren't to a kidnapper. They were directly to Mara.
It's very interesting and contradictory almost.
Right, exactly. It's contradictory because he's always criticized the local law enforcement, correct?
Right. And I mean, yeah, after, and you know, I'll be honest, you probably already know my theory because I've been trying to kind of stay away from it, but I think that Mara went to the White Mountains to do personal harm to herself. That's my theory. It's based on a lot of years of research, but it doesn't mean it's true. Doesn't mean it's true at all. So, but that is my theory. But anyway, what I'm getting at is I think Fred Murray knew how urgent it was the minute he found out where Mara was. Once he found out she was in the same area that they were in just a couple months earlier, and I think he knew that after spending that weekend with her at campus that she wasn't in the best mental state at the time. She just had her breakdown at work, and who knows what all went on that weekend. I think he knew that they better find her within the next 24 to 48 hours or it's going to be too late.
And that's why he changed his story, you think?
Yeah, as I think after a very short amount of time, I think he knew she was no longer alive. And then it's like, you know, you're going to let all this stuff come out about your daughter, or you just want to, you know, I think he just at that point just wanted to focus on how bad of a job the police did as far as not finding her in time, you know. That's just a personal opinion right there. That's not fact. I mean, they can't count that down as fact or anything, but that's my opinion. Yeah.
It's really interesting because to the people who believe that Fred aided Mara in getting away or in disappearing and maybe gave her that $4,000, Fred wouldn't have wanted the police to search that hard. So he wouldn't have changed his story, right?
Yeah, I don't think you, and he's also trying to get the FBI involved. He's trying to go down and beat down on the doors of legislators and he's trying to get, you know, everything he can about the case. And you know, I think if you really were covering up something that, you'd still have to put on some kind of an act, but yeah, he's definitely going the extra mile if this is all an act and he was involved in her disappearance in some way.
Right, and wasn't he on private property in the weeks and months after her disappearance and people had called the police and they came out, and wasn't he kind of wandering or like searching through
that
area?
He came back all the time. He had a
came back right to that scene.
Right. He had a contracting job. I think he was a radiologist. He had a contracting job in Connecticut that went on for several years. And so he'd come back, I think it was every other weekend. I'm not 100% sure on that, but he would come back and he would be right around the area where her car went missing. He would do his own little searches there. And finally, at some point, he brought in some investigators. And that's when you heard about the rusty knife and the A-frame house and all this other stuff that came out about finding evidence, and that was all done by him and his investigators.
So thank you very much to Clint Harding for that interview. That was pretty interesting stuff, huh, Lance?
Yeah, seriously. He provided a lot of information that comes from the early part of this investigation, which is what we're looking for. You know, he's talking about, in detail, he's talking about the phone calls that Mara got the night that she was escorted back to her dorm by Karen Mayotte. I thought that was really interesting. I thought it was really interesting that he took the trip up there and what he has in his head, this like picture of her supervisor guiding her back, like holding her and guiding her back to her dorm, which is that's the picture that we've all kind of got in our heads about this, is that she walks her back and, you know, guides her to her room and, you know, tucks her in and everything.
Yeah,
and it's literally like next door. It's like a couple of steps. So
yeah,
he really put things into perspective there for me with the visual.
Yeah, and as far as some of the speculation we were doing, trying to get into some of the details of the Patrite Vassy accident and everything, we, you know, we're just trying to explore all avenues with this, all possibilities. I mean, we don't know what happened. We're not trying to push any theories. We're just trying to explore all likely scenarios.
Right. And we wouldn't be exploring this scenario if the Patrice Vassy accident happened the night before.
Right.
It happened in a time frame that is pretty ideal for what went down with Mora that night.
If you believe that Mora struck Patrice Vassy, then you likely should believe that Billy Rausch knows that.
Exactly. Based on Mora's reaction after, based on the fact that she had her cell phone with her, and based on the fact that that call was actually made, and the fact that Patrice was hit during that time. So if you do believe that, yeah, absolutely.
No matter what your theory is, this interview just shook it all up.
It completely shook it all up for me, because I'm listening to this guy, Clint, and he's like, you know, I'm listening to a real guy with, you know, the accent, and he doesn't sound like he's got any ulterior motive there, right?
I don't think so.
No agenda. You know, he went into this because it's in him to find truth in things.
Yeah, he's a real truth seeker. And we'll have Clint back on to talk more about the A-frame house and the rusty knife that he mentioned. Thank you very much for listening.